The mouse didn't go into either of the occupied cells, only the empties. And finally it had worked its way almost up to where we were. I kept expecting it to turn back, but it didn't. It showed no fear of us at all. "It ain't normal for a mouse to come up on people that way," Dean said a little nervously. "Maybe it's rabid."
"Oh, my Christ," Brutal said through a mouthful of corned beef sandwich. "The big mouse expert, the mouse man. You see it foaming at the mouth, mouse man?"
"I can't see its mouth at all," Dean said, and that made us all laugh again. I couldn't see its mouth either, but I could see the dark little drops that were its eyes, and they didn't look crazy or rabid to me. They looked interested and intelligent. I've put men to death, men with supposedly immortal souls that looked dumber than that mouse. It scurried up the green mile to a spot that was less than 3 feet from the duty desk, which wasn't something fancy, like you might be imagining, but only the sort of desk the teachers used to sit behind up at the district high school. And there it did stop, curling its tail around its paws as prim as an old lady settling her skirts. I stopped laughing, all at once, suddenly feeling cold through my flesh all the way to the bones. I want to say I don't know why I felt that way. No one likes to come out with something that's going to make them look or sound ridiculous. But of course I do. And if I can tell the truth about the rest, I guess I can tell the truth about this. For a moment, I imagined myself to be that mouse. Not a guard at all, but just another convicted criminal there on the Green Mile, convicted and condemned, but still managing to look bravely up at a desk that must have seen miles high to it, as the judgment seat of God will no doubt someday seem to us, and at the heavy-voiced, blue-coated giants who sat behind it. Giants that shot its kind with BB guns, or swatted them with brooms, or set traps on them, traps that broke their backs while they crept cautiously over the word victor to nibble at the cheese on the little copper plate. There was no broom by the duty desk, but there was a rolling mop bucket with the mop still in the wringer. I'd taken my turn at swabbing the green lino in all six of the cells shortly before sitting down to the record box with Dean. I saw that Dean meant to grab the mop and take a swing with it. I touched his wrist, just as his fingers touched the slender wooden handle. "Leave it be," I said. He shrugged and drew his hand back. I had a feeling he didn't want to swat it any more than I did. Brutal tore a corner off his corned beef sandwich and held it out over the front of the desk, tweezed delicately between two fingers. The mouse seemed to look up with an even livelier interest, as if it knew exactly what it was. Probably did. I could see its whiskers twitch as its nose wriggled.
"Oh, Brutal, no!" Dean exclaimed, then looked at me. "Don't let him do that, Paul. If he's going to feed the damn thing, we might as well put out the welcome mat for anything on four legs."
"I just want to see what he'll do," Brutal said, "in the interest of science-like."
He looked at me. I was the boss, even in such minor detours from routine as this. I thought about it and shrugged like it didn't matter much one way or another. The truth was, I kind of wanted to see what he'd do, too. Well, he ate it, of course. There was a depression on, after all. But the way he ate it fascinated us all. He approached the fragment of sandwich, sniffed his way around it, and then he sat up in front of it like a dog doing a trick, grabbed it, and pulled the bread apart to get at the meat. He did it as deliberately and knowingly as a man tucking into a good roast beef dinner in his favorite restaurant. I never saw an animal eat like that, not even a well-trained house dog. And all the while he was eating, his eyes never left us.
"Either one smart mouse or hungry as hell," a new voice said.
It was Bitterbuck. He had awakened and now stood at the bars of his cell, naked except for a pair of saggy-seated boxer shorts. A home-rolled cigarette poked out from between the second and third knuckles of his right hand, and his iron-gray hair lay over his shoulders, once probably muscular but now beginning to soften, in a pair of braids.
"You got any injun wisdom about mice's chief?" Brutal asked, watching the mouse eat.
We were all pretty fetched by the neat way it held the bit of corned beef in its forepaws, occasionally turning it or glancing at it as if in admiration and appreciation.
"No," Bitterbuck said. "No, the brave once had a pair of what he claimed were mouse-skin gloves, but I didn't believe it."
Then he laughed as if the whole thing was a joke and left the bars. We heard the bunk creak as he lay down again. That seemed to be the mouse's signal to go. It finished up what it was holding, sniffed at what was left, mostly bread with yellow mustard soaking into it, and then looked back at us as if it wanted to remember our faces if we met again. Then it turned and scurried off the way it had come, not pausing to do any cell checks this time. Its hurry made me think of the white rabbit in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and I smiled. It didn't pause at the door to the restraint room, but disappeared beneath it. The restraint room had soft walls for people whose brains had softened a little. We kept cleaning equipment stored in there when we didn't need the room for its created purpose, and a few books. Most were westerns by Clarence Mulford, but one, loaned out only on special occasions, featured a profusely illustrated tale in which Popeye, Bluto, and even Wimpy, the hamburger fiend, took turns stooping olive oil. There were craft items as well, including the crayons Delacroix later put to some good use. Not that he was our problem yet, this was earlier, remember. Also in the restraint room was the jacket no one wanted to wear, white, made of double-sewn canvas, and with the buttons and snaps and buckles going up the back. We all knew how to zip a problem child into that jacket lickety-larrup. They didn't get violent often, our lost boys. But when they did, brother, you didn't wait around for the situation to improve on its own. Brutal reached into the desk drawer above the knee hole and brought out the big leather-bound book with the word Visitors stamped on the front in gold leaf. Ordinarily, that book stayed in the drawer from one month to the next. When a prisoner had visitors, unless it was a lawyer or a minister, he went over to the room off the mess hall that was kept special for that purpose. The arcade, we called it, I don't know why.
"Just what in the gore do you think you're doing?"
Dean Stanton asked, peering over the tops of his spectacles as Brutal opened the book and paged grandly past years of visitors to men now dead.
"Obeying Regulation 19, Brutal said, finding the current page.
He took the pencil and licked the tip, a disagreeable habit of which he could not be broken, and prepared to write. Regulation 19 stated simply, "Each visitor to E-Block shall show a yellow administration pass and shall be recorded without fail."
"He's gone nuts," Dean said to me.
"He didn't show us his pass, but I'm gonna let it go this time," Brutal said.
He gave the tip of his pencil an extra lick for good luck, then filled in 9:49 p.m. under the column headed Time on Block.
"Sure, why not? The big bosses probably make exceptions for mice," I said.
"Of course they do," Brutal agreed. "Black of pockets."
He turned to look at the wall clock behind the desk, then printed 10:01 in the column headed Time Off Block. The longer space between these two numbers was headed Name of Visitor. After a moment's hard thought, probably to muster his limited spelling skills, as I'm sure the idea was in his head already, Brutus Howell carefully wrote Steamboat Willie, which was what most people called Mickey Mouse back in those days. It was because of that first talky cartoon where he rolled his eyes and bumped his hips around and pulled the whistle cord in the pilot house of the steamboat.
"There," Brutal said, slamming the book closed and returning it to its drawer, "all done and buttoned up."
I laughed, but Dean, who couldn't help being serious about things even when he saw the joke, was frowning and polishing his glasses furiously.
"You'll be in trouble if someone sees that."
He hesitated and added, "The wrong someone." He hesitated again, looking near-sightedly around, almost as if he expected to see that the walls had grown ears before finishing, "Someone like Percy kiss my ass and go to heaven Wetmore."
"Huh," Brutal said. "The day Percy Wetmore sits his narrow shanks down here at this desk will be the day I resign."
"You won't have to," Dean said. "They'll fire you for making jokes in the visitor's book if Percy puts the right word in the right ear, and he can. You know he can."
Brutal glowered, but said nothing. I reckoned that later on that night he would erase what he had written. And if he didn't, I would.
The next night, after getting first Bitterbuck and then the President over to D-Block, where we showered our group after the regular cons were locked down, Brutal asked me if we shouldn't have a look for Steamboat Willie down there in the restraint room.
"I guess we ought to," I said.
We'd had a good laugh over that mouse the night before, but I knew that if Brutal and I found it down there in the restraint room, particularly if we found it had gnawed itself the beginnings of a nest in one of the padded walls, we would kill it. Better to kill the scout, no matter how amusing it might be, than have to live with the pilgrims. And I shouldn't have to tell you, neither of us was very squeamish about a little mouse murder. Killing rats was what the state paid us for, after all. But we didn't find Steamboat Willie, later to be known as Mr. Jingles, that night, not nested in the soft walls or behind any of the collected junk we hauled out into the corridor. There was a great deal of junk, too, more than I would have expected, because we hadn't had to use the restraint room in a long time. That would change with the advent of William Wharton, but of course we didn't know that at the time. Lucky us.
"Where'd it go?"
Brutal asked at last, wiping sweat off the back of his neck with a big blue bandana.
"No hole, no crack, there's that, but..."
He pointed to the drain in the floor. Below the grate, which the mouse could have gotten through, was a fine steel mesh that not even a fly would have passed.
"How'd it get in? How'd it get out?"
"I don't know," I said.
"He did come in here, didn't he? I mean, the three of us saw him."
"Yep, right under the door. He had to squeeze a little, but he made it."
"Gosh," Brutal said, a word that sounded strange coming from a man that big. "It's a good thing the cons can't make themselves small like that, isn't it?"
"You bet," I said, running my eye over the canvas walls one last time, looking for a hole, a crack, anything. There was nothing. "Come on, let's go." Steamboat Willie showed up again 3 nights later, when Harry Terwilliger was on the duty desk. Percy was also on and chased the mouse back down the green mile with the same mop Dean had been thinking of using. The rodent avoided Percy easily, slipping through the crack beneath the restraint room door a hands-down winner. Cursing at the top of his voice, Percy unlocked the door and hauled all that shit out again. It was funny and scary at the same time, Harry said. Percy was vowing he'd catch the goddamn mouse and tear its diseased little head right off. But he didn't, of course. Sweaty and disheveled, the shirt tail of his uniform hanging out in the back, he returned to the duty desk half an hour later, brushing his hair out of his eyes and telling Harry, who had sat serenely reading through most of the ruckus, that he was going to put a strip of insulation on the bottom of the door down there. That would solve the vermin problem, he declared.
"Whatever you think is best, Percy,"
Harry said, turning a page of the Ode Opera he was reading. He thought Percy would forget about blocking the crack at the bottom of that door, and he was right. Chapter 8. Late that winter, long after these events were over, Brutal came to me one night when it was just the two of us, E-Block temporarily empty and all the other guards temporarily reassigned. Percy had gone on to Briar Ridge.
"Come here,"
Brutal said in a funny, squeezed voice that made me look around at him sharply. I had just come in out of a cold and sleety night and had been brushing off the shoulders of my coat prior to hanging it up. "Is something wrong?" I asked.
"No," he said, "but I found out where Mr. Jingles was getting in and out. When he first came, I mean, before Delacroix took him over. Do you want to see?"
Of course I did. I followed him down the green mile to the restraint room. All the stuff we kept stored in there was out in the hall. Brutal had apparently taken advantage of the lull in customer traffic to do some cleaning up. The door was open, and I saw our mop bucket inside. The floor, that same sick lime shade as the Green Mile itself, was drying in streaks. Standing in the middle of the floor was a stepladder, the one that was usually kept in the storage room, which also happened to serve as the final stop for the state's condemned. There was a shelf jutting out from the back of the ladder near the top, the sort of thing a workman would use to hold his toolkit or a painter the bucket he was working out of. There was a flashlight on it. Brutal handed it to me. "Get on up there. You're shorter than me, so you'll have to go pretty near all the way, but I'll hold your legs." "I'm ticklish down there," I said, starting up, "especially my knees." "I'll mind that." "Good," I said. "Because a broken hip's too high a price to pay in order to discover the origins of a single mouse." "Huh?" "Never mind." My head was up by the caged light in the center of the ceiling by then, and I could feel the ladder wiggling a little under my weight. Outside, I could hear the winter wind moaning. "Just hold on to me."
"I got you, don't worry."
He gripped my calves firmly, and I went up one more step. Now the top of my head was less than a foot from the ceiling, and I could see the cobwebs a few enterprising spiders had spun and the crotches where the roof beams came together. I shone the light around, but didn't see anything worth the risk of being up here.
"No," Brutal said, "you're looking too far away, boss. Look to your left where those two beams come together. You see them? One's a little discolored."
"I see."
"Shine the light on the join."
I did, and saw what he wanted me to see almost right away. The beams had been pegged together with dowels, half a dozen of them, and one was gone, leaving a black circular hole the size of a quarter. I looked at it, then looked doubtfully back over my shoulder at Brutal. "It was a small mouse," I said, "but that small, man, I don't think so."
"But that's where he went," Brutal said. "I'm just as sure as houses."
"I don't see how you can be."
"Lean closer, don't worry, I got you, and take a whiff."
I did as he asked, groping with my left hand for one of the other beams and feeling a little better when I had hold of it. The wind outside gusted again. Air puffed out of that hole and into my face. I could smell the keen breath of a winter night in the border south, and something else as well. The smell of peppermint.
"Don't let nothing happen to Mr. Jingles,"
I could hear Delacroix saying in a voice that wouldn't stay steady. I could hear that, and I could feel the warmth of Mr. Jingles as the Frenchman handed it to me. "Just a mouse. Smarter than most of the species, no doubt, but still just a mouse for a that and a that. Except this one had no business being alive at all."
"Don't let that batten hurt my mouse," he'd said.
And I had promised, as I always promised them at the end, when walking the Green Mile was no longer a myth or a hypothesis, but something they really had to do. "Mail this letter to my brother who I haven't seen for 20 years, I promise. Say 15 Hail Marys for my soul, I promise. Let me die under my spirit name and see that it goes on my tombstone, I promise." It was the way you got them to go and be good about it, the way you saw them into the chair sitting at the end of the Green Mile with their sanity intact. I couldn't keep all of those promises, of course, but I kept the one I made to Delacroix. As for the Frenchman himself, there had been hell to pay. The Baden hadn't been allowed to hurt the mouse, not a second time, but he had hurt Delacroix. Hurt him plenty. Oh, I know what he did, all right, but no one deserved what happened to Edouard Delacroix when he fell into old Sparky's savage embrace. A smell of peppermint. And something else. Something back inside that hole.
I took a pen out of my breast pocket with my right hand, still holding onto the beam with my left, not worried anymore about Brutal inadvertently tickling my sensitive knees. I unscrewed the pen's cap one-handed, then poked the nib in and teased something out. It was a tiny splinter of wood, which had been tinted a bright yellow. And I heard Delacroix's voice again, so clearly this time that his ghost might have been lurking in that room with us, the one where William Wharton spent so much of his time. "Hey, you guys," the voice said this time, the laughing, amazed voice of a man who has forgotten, at least for a little while, where he is and what awaits him. "Come and see what Mr. Jingles can do."
"Christ," I whispered.
I felt as if the wind had been knocked out of me.
"You found another one, didn't you?" Brutal asked. "I found three or four."
I came down and shone the light on his big outstretched palm. Several splinters of wood were scattered there, like jackstraws for elves. Two were yellow, like the one I had found, one was green and one was red. They hadn't been painted, but colored, with wax Crayola crayons.
"Oh, boy," I said in a low, shaky voice. "Oh, hey, it's pieces of that spool, isn't it? But why? Why up there?"
"When I was a kid, I wasn't big like I am now," Brutal said. "I got most of my growth between 15 and 17. Until then, I was a shrimp. And when I went off to school the first time, I felt as small as... why, as small as a mouse, I guess you'd say. I was scared to death. So you know what I did?"
I shook my head. Outside, the wind gusted again. In the angles formed by the beams, cobwebs shook in feathery drafts like rotted lace. Never had I been in a place that felt so nakedly haunted. And it was right then, as we stood there, looking down at the splintered remains of the spool which had caused so much trouble, that my head began to know what my heart had understood ever since John Coffey had walked the Green Mile. I couldn't do this job much longer. Depression or no depression, I couldn't watch many more men walk through my office to their deaths. Even one more might be too many.
"I asked my mother for one of her hankies," Brutal said. "So when I felt weepy and small, I could sneak it out and smell her perfume and not feel so bad."
"You think... what? That mouse chewed off some of that colored spool to remember Delacroix by? That a mouse?" He looked up. I thought for a moment I saw tears in his eyes, but I guess I was probably wrong about that.
"I ain't saying nothing, Paul, but I found them up there, and I smelled peppermint same as you. You know you did. And I can't do this no more. I won't do this no more. Seeing one more man in that chair just about kill me. I'm going to put in for a transfer to Boys Correctional on Monday. If I get it before the next one, that's fine. If I don't, I'll resign and go back to farming."
"What did you ever farm besides rocks?"
"It don't matter."
"I know it doesn't," I said. "I think I'll put in with you." He looked at me close, making sure I wasn't just having some sport with him, then nodded as if it was a settled thing. The wind gusted again, strong enough this time to make the beams creak and settle, and we both looked around uneasily at the padded walls. I think for a moment we could hear William Wharton... not Billy the Kid, not him, he had been Wild Bill to us from his first day on the block, screaming and laughing, telling us we were going to be damned glad to be rid of him, telling us we would never forget him. About those things he was right.
As for what Brutal and I agreed on that night in the restraint room, it turned out just that way. It was almost as if we had taken a solemn oath on those tiny bits of colored wood. Neither of us ever took part in another execution. John Coffey was the last.